The following program is brought to you in living color.
And the following is a Steel production.
Ladies and gentlemen, the news we've all been waiting for, that news has just come to us from Washington. Japan accepts surrender terms of the Allies. So for all of you who are so interested, for all of us from coast to coast, there are just 7 important words from Washington. Japan accepts surrender terms of the Allies.
If you heard that broadcast, if you were around to hear it, on WIBC, 1070 AM at the time, 70 years ago, you would have heard an incorrect broadcast. That was on August 12th of 1945, a false report that Japan had finally surrendered and ended World War II, as the Mutual Network broadcasters immediately followed up and told us.
We'll have many more important items concerning that little 7-word sentence to give to you. But we knew that you wanted it immediately, and we've just been told now to temporarily hold up that flash to disregard it. So, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who may have heard that flash, as we brought it to you within seconds of the time that it came upon our United Press tickers, please hold up that flash. Temporarily, we resume the program in progress, but keep tuned to this station for further details every second.
It turns out the United Press wire was wrong. 2 days later, however, it would be true, and it came in the middle of the night. Here on WIBC, we were airing a Mutual Networks broadcast of Cab Calloway's band, live from the Cafe Zanzibar in New York City. It was just before 2 o'clock in the morning, Eastern wartime.
From the Mutual Newsroom in New York, Tokyo Radio says acceptance of Potsdam Proclamation coming soon. I repeat, Tokyo Radio says acceptance of Potsdam Proclamation coming soon. One moment, please.
Even though word of Japan's surrender would not be official until President Truman announced it at 7 o'clock on August 14th, the war was over, and the celebration here in Indianapolis and around the country and indeed around the free world was underway and would continue for a long time. The way we heard about the end of the war was the way much of America, indeed almost all of America, heard about most of the war, and that was on the radio, the most immediate way to get news during World War II, indeed leading up to World War II for the previous 10 or 15 years. The best person I think to talk to about that is a guy that I've wanted to talk to for a long time and finally getting to do so. He is a Radio Hall of Famer. He is probably the foremost expert on old-time radio that I know of. He was the creator of a great show that I still listen to. It's hosted by Steve Darnall, who's been on the program a couple times. He created Those Were the Days in Chicago, actually technically in Evanston, if you want to be. It's on the air in Chicago and still is 45 years later. Created a host of other great shows. He has a fantastic website with just a wealth of archived material right now, speakingofradio.com. Mr. Chuck Shaden is with me to talk about radio and what it sounded like when the war finally came to an end. Mr. Shaden, it's a pleasure to talk to you. How are you today?
I'm just fine, and it's a pleasure to speak with you too, Ray.
Man, the end of the war and listening to some of the things that you have at Speaking of Radio, I'm actually not quite through with your archived Those Were the Days broadcast that covered the dropping of the atomic bombs and the waiting that the nation was going through in the days after the bombs were dropped. And there were starting to trickle out reports from Japan and from elsewhere that, yes, Japan was going to offer to surrender, though nothing would be confirmed for several days after that. And I can just imagine people, especially if someone had a service member somewhere around the world, waiting to see, is this finally it? Is this war finally coming to an end? And it would take seemingly forever. Even though it was only a couple days, it would take a long time to get that answer.
Absolutely. And the anxiety among the Americans and among people in the world was very, very high. And everybody tuned into the one place they could get the news as quickly as they possibly could in those days, and that was the radio. In fact, radio was the place to get all of the news, basically, as it was happening during World War II. Yes, the newspapers covered everything, but it wasn't as immediate as you could touch your dial and then tune into what was happening. The first inkling of all of this stuff happened on the actually the 9th of August in 1945. President Truman had just returned from Berlin and the Potsdam Conference, and he was reporting to the American public. And he said during that broadcast, quote,
"The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans."
And that was a collective sigh, could have been heard from coast to coast and almost everywhere except in Japan. The reporters of all of the networks were quick to start reporting. H.B. Kaltenborn on the next the day or two after that, and Caesar Searchinger reported that...
"We are here in the NBC newsroom with the bulletins coming in constantly on Japan's surrender offer. And with every minute that passes, it seems more certain that the offer is definite and that there is a 9 out of 10 chance that it will be accepted."
The big hang-up, of course, was whether or not the Emperor of Japan would continue to be the Emperor of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this stuff was speculative back on that long weekend of waiting, the weekend of that began on Thursday, the 9th of August, with Truman's announcement. So it was a very dramatic time, and no one wanted to be very far from a radio. Not too many portable radios around at that time, so you always stayed close to an in-house radio, or radios were on in factories and offices and virtually everywhere you went. If you went to a motion picture theater, there'd be a big radio in the lobby that was playing perhaps NBC or CBS or the Mutual Network, giving the news of what was going on, and there was a lot of recapping and speculation. People like Lowell Thomas was reporting. In fact, on Friday, the 10th of August, Lowell Thomas said that the
White House announces that there will be no new statement until tomorrow. This means, of course, that discussions by radio telephone are being held. Discussions concerning Japan's offer of surrender. Washington, London, Moscow, and Chongqing now framing their decision. When this decision will be communicated to Tokyo via the governments of Switzerland and Sweden, we are not told.
Every place was forming their decision, and then that decision of the governments of Switzerland and Sweden had to be related to the Japanese government. So it was a very, very tense time, and everyone was worrying about the last shot that was to be fired, because after this happening, the last shot was going to kill some poor people.
Mm-hmm.
After the big intention of the end of the war was going to be there. Amazing time.
If I recall, the first report of surrender, and you can obviously correct me if I'm wrong here, would have been, it was early morning, and because I recall hearing the clip of, it was a Cab Calloway big band remote from New York, presumably, and it was interrupted, and as I recall, that was a Mutual Network remote, because WIBC, this station,
That's
at least
right.
in its previous incarnation, 1070, was a Mutual affiliate back then.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's, I didn't mean to interrupt. Was that the first announcement? And that was like 2 o'clock in the morning or something, that we had the first announcement that Japan might have offered to surrender.
That's right. Newsrooms all over America were monitoring everything they possibly could, and Cab Calloway and the orchestra was broadcasting.
Mutual brings you from the new Zanzibar, Broadway and 49th Street in the heart of New York City, His Highness of Tidy Ho, Cab Calloway and all the lads.
There were many interruptions for reports of the Japanese surrender, but it was very early on Tuesday morning, the 14th of August, that the first reports of the official surrender came in. And then later that day, Tuesday, at approximately 7 p.m., a reporter at Truman's news conference relayed the official news of the Japanese surrender.
Yeah, go ahead. "I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government." This is President Truman's statement. "In reply to the message forwarded to the Japanese government by the Secretary of State on August the 11th, and I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan."
So even though Cab Calloway had his program had been interrupted a few times, there was still nothing official until the President Truman news conference. And then we had everything laying out there for us, although they did announce over many of the networks that there was going to be no official VJ Day until the terms of the surrender would be signed.
Now, that day, or the following couple of days, obviously was heavy news programming. Mm-hmm. Was it the case, though, because with the previous big events during the war, unlike what we might see today on television or with us here, what we do in radio now, where we would go simply wall-to-wall with coverage, I know in previous events, the networks would sometimes go out of their way to try to keep at least some of the regular broadcast schedule, the regular entertainment shows, be they soap operas in the afternoon or some of the bigger entertainment shows in the evening, to try to keep those at least in part on schedule, even if they were from time to time interrupted by news coming from the war. When the war was finally coming to an end, was that the same situation? Because I know I've heard a lot of news broadcasts, especially the early reports of the possible surrender on your program and your archive at speakingofradio.com. It was heavy news, and even though they were essentially repeating themselves over and over again, it was nothing but news reports or attempts at news reports and commentary in the beginning there.
Well, that's true. It was because the public wanted the news. They wanted something, and they mm-hmm. and they even though there might be an entertainment show on the air, they were willing to let it go so they could find out what was happening, because this is the end of a big long period of time for the American public, and they wanted to know what was going on. And if it was a case like that almost all through the war years, from 1941 all the way on through the end of the war in the summer of 45, they would announce at the beginning of network entertainment shows that
the entire facilities of NBC are geared to give you the latest invasion news. Bulletins will be broadcast as soon as they're received in the NBC newsroom.
And so forth and so on. So it became even more so at the end here. And even though they didn't have much to report, they were repeating and repeating. This is what happens even today on television.
Sure.
With any kind of breaking news, they don't have all the news yet, but they still are repeating and repeating because everybody wasn't there at the same time, or isn't there at the same time. So it happened that way, and everyone was just waiting to hear all of this sort of thing, because you can imagine how many people in this country had still men in the service. There were a lot of them who had come home, but they had come home with wounds and with handicaps from being in the battles. So here now, they were just ready to get anything, and they wanted that official news, and that's what they wanted. And so that's what they got.
Chuck Shaden is with me. Mr. Shaden is a Radio Hall of Famer, and again, he has collected, and well, he's since donated much of that collection of old-time radio shows to the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. He created a number of old-time radio programs over the years. And his site is speakingofradio.com, where you can go back and listen to his Those Were the Days programs, archived from many years ago. But you know, the ones that I've been most interested in were those that you did. Well, they were originally broadcast, your shows were 20 years ago, but they were observing the then 50th anniversary of World War II. And now here we are 20 years later with the 70th anniversary of what is now the end of the war. What I was struck about a lot of the news broadcasts was the commentary. Because a lot of us think, and I think mistakenly believe, that, well, there was a time when news people would just come on and do the news. And that was true to an extent, but you take Lowell Thomas, for instance. He would come on and he would do the news, but at the same time, he would try to analyze what was going on and provide that analysis while he was giving the news. Ed Murrow and all the great newsmen of CBS, or at least a lot of them, did the same thing. They were trying to interpret what was happening for the listener, particularly when they didn't have a lot of official information. They were saying, well, this could mean this, this could mean that, and they were piecing that together and interspersing that with, you mentioned H.V. Kaltenborn, the commentary from all of the numerous commentators that were on the air at the time.
Well, these people were all very much informed, and they knew what was going on, and they had all of the facts, and they couldn't report everything they knew on a 5, 10, or 15-minute commentary program, but they were drawing on all their experience and knowledge to speculate on what could happen until they really got the final word that was coming down. And people like Robert Trout for CBS and Gabriel Heater on the Mutual Broadcasting Company. At one point, Heater was on the air speculating, even civil war in Japan isn't ruled out as a possibility now, he said. Their people know nothing, even now, regarding their surrender offer.
Will the reply reveal a new government in Japan? A government whose purpose would be more delay. You remember all the changes before Pearl Harbor.
And that was broadcast on Monday evening, the 13th of August. So there was chaos everywhere over there, so they weren't being told. We were speculating on all of this sort of thing. And there was a lot of jumping the gun, too, on some of this stuff. The cities, you couldn't hold back the cities and the towns of America from celebrating, even though the final declaration of war had not been accepted yet. I mean, Chicago had a big celebration. Milwaukee had a big celebration.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Johnson in front of the Riverside Theater in downtown Milwaukee. This is the kind of day you wait 3.5 years for, and after it finally comes, you hope to high heaven you're never going to have to wait for another one like it after you consider the cause. You can already hear an awful lot of crowd noise down here. Hear these multitudes of people on either side of the street.
It's not at all surprised that Indianapolis had a gigantic celebration.
Yeah.
Some of those things are not recorded in history. They have not surfaced at any rate. But it was a fantastic, fantastic time. And hearts were in the throats of everyone waiting for those final news. But it was official on the 14th of August. And you knew it was official when Orson Welles and Norman Corwin got on radio over the Columbia Broadcasting System on the evening of the 14th of August and did a program entitled 14 August, which was a message for the Day of Victory, written and produced and edited by Corwin and spoken by Orson Welles. And it was a look at the awful effect of the weapon that was used to end the war.
And the upward path has been strewn with dinosaurs, tigers, Caesars, slave traders, and fascists, in spite of which, as you have heard on the radio tonight, the best in the way of flags is flying over the once mighty lands of the enemy, and free men are being born on schedule.
So even though this terrible weapon was the conduit to the end of the hostilities, it was even at that point considered, should it have been done?
I was about to ask, before I get to that, go back to the celebrations very quickly. And one of my favorite clips of all time anywhere was the official word of the end of the war. And you talk about celebrations and Bob Trout going on CBS. And this is one where somebody might go into an archive on the internet and they'll say, oh, this is Robert Trout announcing the end of the war. And you'll hear
7 p.m. Eastern wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
If you hear that, that's not actually how it happened. That was a recreation, I believe, that Trout did a few years later. Because the actual announcement, when he made it, if I recall, he made it, and as soon as he read the bulletin on the air, you heard this big whoop and cheer.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington, and I didn't expect to hear a celebration here.
From the newsroom, within the newsroom,
right.
Then all of a sudden the signal gets cut. I don't know if somebody tripped over a wire or what happened. I know Bob Trout told that story, I believe, many years later, that something had happened and had cut their network feed off. And when CBS wanted to do a retrospective, I believe, a few years later, he had to go and recreate that. But you can't recreate an emotion like what was felt in that newsroom. And as you said, everywhere when the war finally ended.
Yeah, you know, that's almost a gut reaction there. When the newsroom erupted in cheers, some very well-trained engineer probably pulled the plug because that was not the kind of response you were supposed to get. That was that was letting your hair down.
Yeah.
But it reflected the thoughts of everybody. And later on in a broadcast, Trout said it's now 3 years and 8 months. It was 192 weeks ago that the American people learned that war had come to the United States. And now, almost 4 years of work and struggle, grief and failure, and later success. And then he said, whether Sunday the 12th, now this was just before all the official stuff happened, whether Sunday, August 12th, is to be written into the records as the day the Second World War ended, we do not yet know, he said. But we knew very soon, within probably 24 hours of that, it was there, and kids were riding their bicycles and waving flags in every neighborhood in America.
Hmm. You mentioned Norman Corwin's program, yes. 14 August, Orson Welles read Norman Corwin's magnificent writing. I don't know if Norman Corwin wrote something bad, I would love to see it, because I don't think think that actually took place. But you mentioned how it described the use of the atomic bomb, and it's, as you said, it's similar to the talk that we still have today. Here we are 70 years later, as we record this, it's exactly 70 years after Hiroshima.
Yes.
And as devastating as that was, just about anybody you talk to, and I talked to a gentleman who's a friend of mine, he is a World War II veteran, he was training to be part of the invasion force of Japan. He would have invaded Japan had we not dropped the bomb. And us dropping the bomb was as big a surprise to him as anybody, because naturally they didn't want to tell anybody about this secret weapon that we were about to unleash on Japan. And so he was relieved because he knew it probably saved his life. And a lot of people thought that way.
Absolutely. Well, I had an uncle who was expected to board a ship on its way for the invasion of Japan when they got the news. Hmm. He never got on that ship, and he was very grateful. And all his life, he was grateful that because you don't know what was going to happen. And without some super weapon like the atom bomb, which was not known to everybody, I guess the supposition was that the Japanese were going to fight to the last man, and mm-hmm. I kind of believe that they would have. So there's still a divided opinion on Mr. Truman's decision, but there was no division of on the part of those people who were headed for that final fight. You know?
Sure, and I think Norman Corwin's piece took the appropriate tone, as like, it's almost as if, we had to do this now, but let's hope that we never see something like this again.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Now, the rest of the entertainment lineup, because I recall VE Day, Victory in Europe, when Germany surrendered, and the programs that were on celebrating that victory, but knowing that we still had Japan to defeat. And at the time, we didn't really know how long the war with Japan would continue. We knew the tide had turned. We did not know it would be just a few months later. And therefore, then, when the programs came on, and they were playing the celebratory music, and here's Bing Crosby, here's Fibber McGee and Molly, it was a happy mood, but it was tempered at the same time. Post VJ Day, I imagine that was a bit different.
Well, post VJ Day was a little bit different, because what had happened after VE Day, Victory in Europe, there was a big sigh of relief, a collective sigh of relief on the part of the American public. And the government was concerned that they would stop collecting scrap iron, they would stop saving newspapers, they mm-hmm. would stop giving blood, they would stop all of the things that they had been doing. And so there was a concerted effort led by the radio to remind people that the war was still on and there was still a job to do, and an important job to do. So they did that, and that was reflected in many of the entertainment programs. You mentioned Bing Crosby and Fibber McGee and Molly. They were at the forefront of patriotism during most of their broadcast during those war years. After the war was over, then we had some of the programs. The war ended in the middle of the summer. The Japanese war ended. If not officially, it was over.
Oh, yes, so the regular programs would have been off then.
They would have been off. However, there was, for example, there was an Eddie Cantor program on a Wednesday night on the 15th of August. Cantor wasn't there because it was a summer replacement program, but following the official news of the Japanese surrender, the program offered a special salute to the end of the war. Then there was a Chase and Sanborn program. Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen were off for the summer. But Francis Langford and Tony Romano and Spike Jones and the City Slickers were on the program. No comedy, but there was a lot of military and patriotic songs being broadcast during that show. So we had all of that for a long time. And other programming that was on until the formal official VJ Day, which became the 2nd of September, where the Japanese surrender was broadcast worldwide from the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay.
It's always interesting looking back at various events, and you could cite World War II, you could cite September 11th, 2001, or anything like that that has happened, and how long it takes for us as a nation to feel like it's okay to laugh again, if you will. And I'm going to go back to another one of your early programs. We'll go back to the beginning of the war, right after Pearl Harbor. And this was, I guess, 2 days after Pearl Harbor, when Franklin Roosevelt had his first fireside chat. And just before that was a Fibber, McGee, and Molly program. And during that show, Molly, if you will, Marion Jordan, made, I guess, the first war joke. What probably might not have been the first war joke, but it's the first one that a lot of people might remember. She said something about there was a globe that was a prop on the program.
You want a globe with Japan on it, Mr. Mayor?
Why, certainly.
Well, then you better get one quick.
That's right. We received tremendous response from the studio audience, you know.
And so you wonder how you come through a somber time, and you know, here we are, end of the war. My gosh, it's finally over. Yes, let's celebrate. But at the same time, we've lost so many people over these past 4 years. So it takes a while, I guess, to come back to as far as normal programming. You know, obviously, you have to wait until the fall season of radio before you would hear the big names, the Jack Bennies and people like that.
But there were a lot of references to the end of the war, and then there would be that would be followed by a lot of references to wartime shortages, the scarcity of lodging because so many servicemen were coming home from overseas, and then, you know, programs like when Bob Hope returned to the air after in September of 45. On his first show of the season, he saluted Hollywood's contribution to the war effort.
You know, I'm really thrilled tonight because they requested me to keep appearing before military audiences. What I didn't like about it, the request came from civilian audiences. But it's great to be back. Coming home is really something. When we flew over New York, I felt a real tug at my heart. My girdle had caught in the Bombay door.
And they just, that's what they talked about. They talked about the radio, special radio programming, programs that were recorded in the States for broadcast to the servicemen around the world, specific programs from Armed Forces Radio like Command Performance and the GI Journal and the GI Jive and things of that nature. And in fact, there was even the biggest program for military audiences was Command Performance. And on the night of the formal signing of the surrender of Japan, the 2nd of September, there was a special VJ Day program for military audiences as well as civilian audiences. It was broadcast on all the U.S. networks and all around the world on shortwave.
Yep, the shooting's over. Big guns are stilled. Once again, a bazooka is something Robin Burns plays on his radio program. And a tank is what you fill up at a gasoline station. No coupons necessary. A lot of husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and mothers are closer together tonight than they've been in 4 long years.
This all-star cast observed the end of the war with Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, Dinah Shore, Frank Sinatra, Orson Welles, Meredith, Major Wilson, and the Armed Forces Orchestra, even President Truman had a message of victory for the American public. And then Hope, on his first broadcast, well, I mentioned that, they saluted Hollywood's contribution mm-hmm. to the war effort. So it was an easy slide. And many programs later on, I think in the sometime in the fall, Frank Sinatra got on the air, and he said, for the first wartime Thanksgiving now, since the war ended, the first peacetime Thanksgiving, he mm-hmm. said. And they would talk about that. And so it tapered off, but it took a long time for it to taper off. But everyone was grateful that the war was over. And I guess the feeling in the country was a great relief, and we're glad to get back to having some real comedy, for example, instead of comedy that was laced with, we know this war is on, and there's a tentativeness about it and all that sort of thing. It was an incredible period of time.
Now, you were young during the war, and what always struck me about some of the wartime programming were the programs that were aimed at children and how they treated the subject of war. And, you know, for example, when a big event would happen, whether it was D-Day or VE Day or VJ Day, whether the children's programs would make sure to mention that, to try to relate that to the kids, you know, because, I mean, a lot of kids obviously had, their dads were away fighting, sure. or their moms were working a wartime job instead of being at home a lot. It changed a lot for the kids, and the children's programming was even, you know, heavily laced with references to the war and what was happening now. Even a program like The Lone Ranger, which is about the farthest thing from present-day wartime, at least during World War II, that you can think of. But, you know, they would work those references in and aim them at people who were your age back during the war.
Well, for The Lone Ranger, they didn't have any wartime references in the storyline, but mm-hmm. in the commercials or the wraparounds, they would have references to things of the nature. Don't forget to save, bring your scrap newspaper to the school paper drive and so forth and so on. Speaking of The Lone Ranger, after the war, the sponsor, which was Cheerios, I believe, even offered an atom bomb ring.
Oh, wow.
Which was you figure out why are they talking about an atom bomb ring on The Lone Ranger? I mean, he wouldn't have it, but he didn't have it. They said you could get this, and it was like a silver bomb with a little red tail on it, clipped onto a ring, and you'd send away with it for a couple of box stops and maybe a dime and get this ring, and you'd take the tail off of the ring, hold it up to a light, because it had a reflective thing in there, and then you'd run into your closet and close the door and then pull the tail off again, and you'd see the atoms being broken in the, you know, just in your little, you hold it up to your eye and see that.
Uh-huh.
But other programs, during the war, they incorporated, in before the war, there were a lot of sinister people on radio in the kids' shows. Dick Tracy was fighting them, and Terry and the Pirates was fighting these unknown people and all of that stuff, or undesignated nationalities. But once the war started, now they were fighting the Germans, and they were going after German spies, and there were the Nazis, or there were the Japanese here, and a lot of the heavies were Japanese, and they were doing all of this stuff. And then there was the heroics that were going on. Our allies were being brought into the stories and talking about that sort of thing. So the kids were well aware of the war, and I think when it was, I think it was VE Day, when Tom Mix made some announcement at the end of the showgram, the war is over in Europe, but we still got a battle to do yet. So fellows and gals, let's buy those stamps at school and so forth, the war stamps.
Yeah, my kids are into, because of me, all the old Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies and the old Warner Brothers cartoons and all those old cartoons. It's the same thing, though. You go back, and because I had to explain, I forget the name of the cartoon. It's where Daffy Duck is trying to keep a military secret from a seductive female duck Nazi spy. And you know, and I'm trying to explain this to my kids, and they probably think it's crazy, but at the same time, it's Daffy Duck, so it's still funny. But the symbols of Hitler in the cartoon and how that was so ubiquitous in all the children's programming, and some you know, of course you can't show anymore because it's not politically correct to do
That's
so
because
right, it,
yeah.
it contains some very bad stereotypes of Germans and Japanese especially. So anyway,
you know, you mentioned something about I was a kid during the war. It's with my involvement in doing this kind of a radio program over the years. Now, I lived through the war. I was 7 years old when I first heard on the radio they interrupted the Shadow. I was on my floor in the living room listening to the Shadow, and he interrupted and talked about the bombing of Pearl Harbor on that Sunday in 1941. But I lived through the war as a kid from a family who had aunts, or rather uncles, in the service, and everybody doing their effort for the war effort some way. And then in 1991, after I'd had my radio show for about 20 years, it was the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, so I decided to set upon what I call a four-year odyssey of listening to what listeners heard on radio during World War II. And we finished that in 1995. And then 4 years ago, I decided to start adding these things to the website that I have. And now, so this is the third victory in over Japan that I've been through in my lifetime. But this shows how radio listened to the war day by day, week by week, because we weren't randomly playing these programs. We were playing them day and date, once a week.
Yeah.
We were on once a week. And so on a Saturday, for example, when we were doing our regular show, we might have events that were broadcast either in the week before or the week ahead. So we'd stay consistent with it. And we'd play news broadcasts and speeches. We had many FDR fireside chats, talks by Winston Churchill. Madam Chiang Kai-shek was a speaker on one. And then all the entertainment programs, whether they had the theme of World War II, some kind of a World War II theme, even if it was a comedy show. Fibber and Molly, as I said, were great. One time Fibber was trying to track a man across the street from his house on Wistful Vista Avenue, thinking he was a Nazi spy. And on another show, Molly was checking into seeing if she could join the WACS, the Women's Army Corps. So they had stuff like that. And so it was, we were all together. That was the thing. It brought us all together. And again, talking about Fibber and Molly, Johnson's Wax, their longtime sponsor, announced openly many times on their show that they would, you know, they would relinquish the commercial today so that we could tell you this urgent message. And then Harlow Wilcox would talk about the need for blood, or, you know, people donating blood, or the need for people to help roll bandages for the American Red Cross, or make sure you do your quota, do your part, sign up for the Bond the Month plan, or kids save your stamps and buy them at school, the war stamps. It was an incredible effort, and that's what really brought us to victory in Japan and victory over Europe.
Indeed it did. Completely unrelated. One time my daughter caught me listening to, my younger daughter, she's seven now, caught me listening to Fibber McGee and Molly, and Wallace Wimple comes on, Bill Thompson, the lovely Bill Thompson doing Wallace Wimple, and she heard it, and she's like, why is Droopy on that radio show?
That's right.
Oh man, he was fantastic. Oh, one last kind of unrelated, well, wartime question. What's the correct pronunciation? Is it rationing, or is it rationing, as half of everybody seemed to say during the war with a long A?
Well, half of the people thought it was rationing, and the other half thought it was rationing, and it didn't make any difference because we all had to live with it. We had these ration books or ration books.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you wanted to buy a pair of shoes, you had to use a coupon in your ration book. And it, I guess it was, you know, a tomato or tomato.
I suppose.
It this didn't is... matter. I mean, there was a, there were radio announcers who said protein and others who said protein.
Oh, Paul Harvey said protein until he died. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, so it was a matter of sometimes it was a matter of how you said it in the South or in the North or the South or
okay,
wherever
maybe
you were
so.
From. Somebody would say protein.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's what you say.
I was just wondering that because I mean Ken Alexander, the great announcer for those yes. were the days, and a great Chicago announcer for a long time. He still says rationing today. I still hear him say it. So.
Well, that's the answer.
Okay.
In my mind, if Ken Alexander says it, then that's what it is.
There you go.
Because when I he's even a stickler on some spelling. When I first compiled a book that I wrote about all of the interviews that I had done with radio personalities over the years, which is called Speaking of Radio, but it, and all those interviews are on my website, but that's secondary. I asked Ken to read all that, you know, we transcribed the interviews to the paper page.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, in many cases, there was a place where you could have two different spellings of a word, and I might opt for this spelling instead of that spelling. But Ken would raise the issue, and invariably, we'd have words about it. But I knew when I was better off to bow into his knowledge, and we use his spelling of it. You know, you go to, I'd point out, look what Webster's Dictionary says, it's either this or that. Either one is okay. But the one that was okay with Ken was the important one.
So, no, he was a classical that. Music station announcer back
Absolutely,
in the day, so that
right.
they know all, I suppose.
Yes, right.
So. That website, by the way, is speakingofradio.com. My goodness, there's, like I said, there's not enough time to listen to everything the way you would like to listen to it, whether it's all of your old Those Were the Days programs, which contain just thousands of old-time radio shows, the interviews that you got to do with the greats of radio, and the supporting players who were just as important, if not more important, the great radio actors that you may not know
yeah.
them by name, but if you've listened to any shows from way back when, you've heard them literally thousands of times, some of them doing several shows a day
right.
when they were working actors. You've got all of those at speakingofradio.com, just a whole lot of stuff. And of course, Those Were the Days continues with our friend Steve Darnall, who does that so capably every Saturday now on WDCB in Chicago. Well, Glen Ellen, Illinois, technically, but WDCB, the college station up there. And it's just it's great that it's still alive and is going to be kept alive for a long time. So we have you to thank for that.
Thank you.
Chuck Shaden, Radio Hall of Famer. It's been great talking to you. As I said, I could take this on for a couple more hours if I wanted to, but really do appreciate your time today, and best of luck to you and everything that you continue to do.
Thank you very much, Ray. I appreciate it, and as always, a pleasure to talk with you.
All right.